If one rejects laissez-faire on account of man's fallibility and moral weakness, one must for the same reason also reject every kind of government action. Welcome to Keith Knight, Don't Tread on Anyone, and the Libertarian Institute. Today we have Dr. James Lindsay of Cynical Theories, how activist scholarship made everything about race, gender, and identity, and why it harms everybody. Dr. Lindsay, thank you so much for your time. Where's the best place to find your archive of work?
I keep the majority of my work at the website that I've created. It's called New Discourses. It's located at newdiscourses.com. Unless you follow me on social media, which is probably where I do most of my work lately, which is its own problem.
Got it. What is critical race theory?
Critical race theory, I'm supposed to be nice to it. critical race theory describes itself as a movement, which is an odd thing for a theory to describe itself as, but is a movement that tries to reassess the relationship between race, racism, and power in society. And that's a very friendly way to put it. It's a view that takes the position that racism is systemic in society. It's not a matter necessarily of individual intention or individual action, although certainly individuals can act or be racist. Or act in racist ways. But it views racism ultimately as a system that operates in society at every level, whether that's through individual actions, whether that's through social norms, whether it's through the way that we talk and think about things, whether it's what we consider knowledge, whether it's our institutions, whether that's criminal justice, or whether that's schooling or any other institution that you might imagine, the government itself. Every level, every single thing has racism taken as its ordinary state of affairs, according to critical race theory. That's the first underlying assumption of critical race theory. Racism is it's systemic in the ordinary state of affairs in society, not an aberration from them. So racism is the default. In other words, guilty until proven innocent of racism in any circumstance. It's a very worrying ideology. There are lots of other principles we could talk about in detail, however long you want to go on about it, but it's a very worrying ideology that I think libertarians in particular should be aware of and concerned about, because it's pretty inimical to libertarian thought completely. In that, first of all, it's collectivist. It separates people according to racial categories and asks them to consider themselves as representatives or avatars of racial collectives. So it's collectivist in that sense. It's not individualist. But it also, and this is a statement that I can quote pretty close to from memory, from the book Critical Race Theory and Introduction, which was written by two critical race theorists that have some significance, Richard Delgado and Jean Stefanchik. And on page 3, literally the first paragraph, they say that they describe what critical race theory is. They say that unlike traditional approaches to civil rights, which favor incremental progress and step-by-step progress, critical race theory questions the very foundations of the liberal order. And by liberal here, we actually mean the same thing that other countries call libertarian, or liberal and libertarian are very similar. We're talking about classical liberalism at its roots. And what do they name as the very foundations of the liberal order? They say including equality theory. So we're going to question equality. They list legal reasoning, so rule of law, enlightenment rationalism, so the idea that human beings are rational agents who can set their own course, that's going to be questioned at its very foundation. And then last, they list the neutral principles of constitutional law. So we're going to question the idea of constitutional law, and especially the idea of applying it neutrally without, say, identity or race-based consciousness attached to it. On page 23 of that book, they start out a rather ominous paragraph with saying crits, meaning critical race theorists, are highly suspicious of another liberal mainstay, namely rights. And that's a direct quote. They are highly suspicious of rights. So they're a collectivist ideology that uses race as its collectivist proxy, that's highly suspicious of things like constitutional law, rationalism, equality, rule of law in particular, and rights, individual rights.
What is postmodernism?
So postmodernism is a school of thought that arose, but it's a very complicated thing and hard to define. It is actually an approach that arose within art and architecture in the 1940s, but it became a philosophical movement. And that's what's more relevant into the 1960s and going into the 1970s, which is when it really took off in the 1970s. So it's an intellectual movement that is very skeptical of the relationship between knowledge and power. So when I said a moment ago that critical race theory takes the assumption that that racism is systemic and that one of the elements of that system is even what we regard as knowledge, this is sort of heavily dependent upon postmodern thinking, which would say that knowledge is a cultural construct, kind of the most core thing. There are lots and lots and lots of things that fall under the postmodern umbrella. Postmodernism naturally resists being defined, but if a core single idea could be defined as being postmodern, it would be that knowledge itself is a cultural construction. It is a contingent property of cultures. So we might have a culture, let's say, you know, it's the 1300s, we're in Europe, or whichever, you know, particular country we're in, we're in that culture, but it has a view that the Earth is at the center of the solar system, that the sun goes around it, and that's considered true. So they have culturally constructed as knowledge a statement that is false, but they treat it as knowledge, they treat it as true, and that cultural construction is what's actually relevant, because that's what's going to be treated as true, that's what's going to be put into power. We see, for example, with the trial of Galileo in the 1600s, early 1600s, that was, you know, when that was challenged, it wasn't taken real well, because the powers that be will lean into what is believed to be knowledge, and then will enforce that through political and social means. You know, maybe if you dispute it, you're crazy, that's a social means, unless they decide to psychopathologize that, and then maybe you get institutionalized, and that might be a state means of coercion, something like this. And so the postmodernism was essentially this very pessimistic philosophy that arose in French circles of thought to try to explore the relationship between knowledge and power primarily. And in fact, to make the case that all claims of knowledge, whether or not they're true or false, is less interesting and less relevant than the systems and dynamics and properties of power, the social institutions and the political processes that enable people to say when something counts as knowledge and when something does not. I have to admit that it's a very dangerous way to think, but that they did have some pretty useful insights given the kind of very technocratic world we're currently threatening ourselves with.
What is theory with a capital T?
Okay, so theory is a very complicated idea. It's kind of the catch-all for all of these different ways of thinking that you might associate now with the woke ideology, if we want to call it that. Theory was the shorthand for postmodern social theory for a long time, but what happened is in the 80s and 90s, it blended with critical theory, and it was taken up, that blending. The people who did that blending were largely literary theorists, so it blended with literary theory as well. So theory becomes this kind of catch-all of literary critical literary theory, or literary criticism, plus critical theory in the sense of the neo-Marxist Frankfurt School idea of critical theory, together with the postmodern social theorizing that wants to analyze the relationship between knowledge and power, that wants to kind of, in the book, in Cynical Theories, we lay out two main principles and four main themes that kind of characterize theory. And those are what I just described in terms of knowledge, is we call it the postmodern knowledge principle. We say there's a political principle as well, a postmodern political principle, which would be generally radical egalitarianism. And so what that means is that if your culture has been in the past excluded, marginalized, oppressed, colonized, or whatever, then the knowledge and the other cultural artifacts of your culture need to be protected and elevated. Whereas if your culture has been dominant, say what they would say is white, Western, Eurocentric, masculinist, all the favorite heteronormative, you know, all these words that indicate so-called dominant perspectives within this view, that those perspectives have been unfairly favored. And so we have to downplay things like white, Western, masculine perspectives, like, say, science under theirs, and upplay to kind of level the playing field, is the phrase, views that are from cultures that have been excluded or marginalized. And so that's called radical egalitarianism, which is, in a sense, the effort to make things more equal, more egalitarian, by cooking the books, tilting it away from that which has had power and influence before and toward that which has not, on the assumption that we must be missing something and that the power is always corruptive, etc. Then we said that there are these four themes, which are the blurring. So this is, I'm saying that this is all kind of what characterizes the behavior theory. There's four themes, one of which is the blurring of boundaries. You know, male and female should not be considered stable categories any longer. Research and storytelling, we should blur the boundaries between those. These kinds of things are their efforts to kind of say that the categorization process is illegitimate and enforces power dynamics and needs to be questioned. And the questioning is usually subversive and calling into question the categories themselves so that their boundaries become blurred together. And it's unclear what they mean. We talk about the power of language, that language is given undue influence. The theory believes that language constructs reality. This is the social constructivist thesis that they operate on. So the way that we talk about things, the way that things are able to be discussed, the parameters of dialogue, the limits of truth and falsity, all construct how people understand reality and thus their interactions with reality itself. So language gets elevated to an extremely high level of importance. We mentioned cultural relativism, which I kind of already touched upon, but that one culture can't judge another, that its artifacts are its own, then that's going to get mixed with that radical egalitarianism to tilt the playing field. And lastly, the denial of the universal and the individual in favor of identity groups or collective groups, cultural groups. And so that's where I think one of the biggest, I mean, all of that falls in conflict with kind of libertarian thought, but especially the denial that we are rational agents who can derive facts about the world and proceed in a logical and rational fashion. But here we see another one, which is the denial that there's universal humanity, thus that natural law might make sense, and the denial that there is that the individual is meaningful. In fact, the theory would regard the individual as having been conditioned by society depending on what identity collectives they happen to belong to. So if you are, for example, Black, then you occupy a particular social position in society, views Blacks and imposes certain things upon being Black, and that essentializes your experience as being Black. And so that's inescapable under this kind of a mindset. So there is no such thing as a Black individual, because a Black individual either is representing that experience correctly, as theory describes it, or they must have false consciousness or internalized racism or something like this, that they're not actually being honest for whatever set of reasons. And the same would go for any identity group or any intersection of identity groups.
The book is Cynical Theories, How Universities Made Everything About Race, Gender, and Identity, and Why It Harms Everybody. What I love about the book is how you guys don't have any assumed knowledge on behalf of the reader. So, well, I think that I know something. The fact that I can't explain it to someone means, all right, I was kidding with myself. I actually don't know it. You guys do a great job of explaining how it's important, citing the primary sources, not like, this is a big deal and you all know it. Well, how do I know it's not some, you know, satanic panic where we all think something just because we're in the same circles? I really love this book and I highly recommend it. What are meta-narratives?
Yeah, so the postmodernism describes itself as skepticism. As this is a quote from Jean-François Lyotard, one of the postmodern philosophers, French postmodern philosophers. And he has a book that came out in 1979 called The Postmodern Condition. And in that book, he says, simplifying to the extreme, I define postmodern as incredulity toward meta-narratives. So meta-narratives are at the heart of the thing that the postmodern project is questioning. And so meta-narratives are the broad sweeping, it's not just stories, but stories about stories that people tell. It's how we contextualize everything in a particular culture. So when we say that it's culturally relativistic, the stories, the story structure, the way that we think about and interact with knowledge and ideas that's at the heart of all of that is a meta-narrative. So we might talk about the Western meta-narrative, or we might talk about more specific meta-narratives like Manifest Destiny that came along, that we were, you know, possessed by this, you know, frontier spirit, and that, you know, we should spread from coast to coast, and it's a manifest destiny, like destiny is playing itself out to get to you know, the complete occupation of the North American and maybe even South American continent. So, and then that could be applied, of course, you know, to traveling to the moon and Mars and so on that they sometimes bring up now. So another one that they criticize as a key meta-narrative that was a problem was the civilizing mission in France. The French colonialists had this idea that they're going around spreading civilization. And of course, so did all the other European colonists. They believe that they're going around spreading civilization to the uncivilized, backwards, barbarian parts of the world. That's a meta-narrative. American exceptionalism is a meta-narrative. But they went further than all of this. By the way, being on the right side of history is a meta-narrative, but that's, I digress. They went further than this, and they started to say that entire systems of thought are meta-narratives. There's a Christian meta-narrative. That's probably correct, broadly speaking, although we'll let the Protestants and the Catholics fight about who has the real Christian meta-narrative. Or maybe they would say that there's a Protestant one and there's a Catholic one. And then there's, they said that the Western liberalism is a meta-narrative. They said that Marxism, in fact, this being a postmodern analysis, which had mostly abandoned that Marxism as a failure, while still retaining much of its kind of underlying, you know, intellectual architecture. But they said that Marxism was a failure. Marxism had a meta-narrative that history was going to progress from capitalism into socialism into communism. That's a meta-narrative. So it's a way of framing all the stories in society. And so that's the thing that they were calling into question. They also said that science and the scientific method constitute a meta-narrative, that we can understand the world, that we can gain insight about the world. So postmodernism is extremely cynical and pessimistic in this regard, because progressivism, the idea that history is going to slowly progress toward better and better, and it never particularly backslides or takes a wrong turn at Albuquerque, that's a meta-narrative. So these are the things that postmodernism said that they are incredulous toward. They don't believe any of it. They believe that basically all descriptions of reality are just cultural constructions, that they're largely false, that they're enforced by consensus. This is kind of summarizing Lyotard's work, where he talked about what was called legitimation by paralogy. And he believed that what happens is that people actually, including in science, they have a consensus view, which is a socially constructed and socially enforced way of thinking about things. And they all tend, everybody in the social structure tends to agree with it, broadly speaking. And so there's a consensus that it's the way things are, or things are true this, or to be interpreted this way, or that this is how things are true. This is how we should approach questions in the world. And all of that is just merely consensus. It is paralogy. It is not logic. It is something that lives beside logic, paralogic. What paralogy means. I've talked to a guy at one point who said that he never understood what paralogy meant until he took a philosophy seminar at a university, and his professor asked, you know, let's talk about Lyotard's legitimation by paralogy. What is paralogy? And they all argued about what it might be and blah, blah, blah. And then finally the professor said, here's an easier way. It's lies.
What is intersectionality?
Okay, so intersectionality is a contemporary concept. I say contemporary. It is the dominant identity theory that's operant right now, even though its creator, whose name is Kimberly Crenshaw, said that she claims, I don't believe her, to be honest with you, but in one of her most influential papers, she claims that she never meant for intersectionality to become a totalizing theory of identity. It is a totalizing theory of identity. So intersectionality starts from the observation that things are, when you have more than one, that if we take, I should say, let me step one step back further. If we take for granted the idea that there might actually be something, you know, within, say, networks of stereotypes or behavior or attitudes toward groups of people in society, that, for example, there are stereotypes toward Black people or stereotypes toward women, stereotypes toward men, or whatever it happens to be, that when you have two or more of these identity categories at one time, it's not as clear, it's not as simple as saying, oh, you know, the things that apply to, say, Black people and the things that apply to women, you take those together, that's what you get for Black women. They get hit with both. It's actually the argument that not only do you get hit with both, but you don't necessarily know which way you're being discriminated against. Plus, there's an additional fact that Black women have their own stereotypes about them and their own axes of discrimination. And so the idea actually arose in law. Kimberly Crenshaw was actually a lawyer. She was at Harvard Law. And her first observation that she brought the concept up, although it really came out of Black feminism from about 12 years earlier, but she wrote this down in 1989, and she analyzed a series of discrimination lawsuits, but most notably one for General Motors. And she pointed out that they were being sued for discrimination against Black women. And the legal defense that they gave said, we're not discriminatory against Black people, and we're not discriminatory against women. And so there's no discrimination. But indeed, the case was that they had lots of Black men working on the factory floor and lots of white women working in the office, but they had very, very few Black women. And there was no legal recourse to figure out what to do with that circumstance. And I admit that that is a thorny and important aspect of discrimination law that does need some attention and would need some attention. But she turned it into this entire totalizing theory of identity that your social position, according to these various belonging to identity groups, the belonging to various identity groups that you might have, is so dramatically not just informative but determinant of your experience that you have to think of yourself in terms of those identity groups and the way that those identity groups interact. So if you're a Black man, you have to be able to come out and they say engaging your positionality. You have to come out and intentionally say, you know, as a Black man, this is where you get these as a identity, blah, blah, blah statements so much. I understand, you know, the Black experience, which is this essentialized Black experience under theory. But I also understand that I occupy the position of dominance that comes with being a man. And so that I need to, you know, be able to defer to that under a radical egalitarian mindset. I need to defer to that female perspective when a woman challenges me. But where it comes to race, I've become an authority because I'm in the marginalized perspective there. And so it's a way of dragging your various identity categories up into relevance on basically everything. Now, this is, again, me being very nice to these things. Intersectionality was created. Kimberly Crenshaw is credited with it. The idea was already floating around for a bit before that. Queer theorists, for example, were already talking about that sex, gender, and sexuality are complicated. They interact somehow. And they very intrinsically interact. And that there's some fundamental difference, for example, between being a gay man and a lesbian woman, even though both are homosexual. And there's some fundamental differences there. And then things would get very complicated. Well, then, even before that, you also had this group. It's called the Combahee River Collective. And this is a mouthful. The short answer is that these were Black feminists. But the reality is that they were lesbians who were queer Black feminist socialists who had formed a collective. And they coined the term identity politics. What we saw in the civil rights movement was not identity politics, because this was in 1977. The Combahee River Collective, I think, was formed in 1974. They coined the term identity politics in 1977. And they were talking about the idea of the intersections between queer politics, Black liberation politics, and feminism over a decade before Kimberly Crenshaw brought it up. And so what you actually see here is that in practice, and this is kind of controversial to say, but it's accurate, is that intersectionality is basically an extortion racket that's built so that queer Black feminist socialists can create a network of solidarity, very much like the mafia would create a network of families that are all going to kick up advantage, resources, money, influence, opportunity, power, etc., toward queer Black feminist socialist women. So what it ultimately boiled, and this was revealed, by the way, I don't want to sound like, you know, you don't read them saying this, but you see it throughout, you know, these ideas like all lives will matter when Black lives matter. So this means that we're now going to do a extortion racket toward Black lives mattering, and all other lives are just going to have to deal with it. And the assumption is that Black lives being the least valued, once they matter, it must imply that all lives matter, which is, of course, a fallacy, because you could easily make it so that Black lives matter and nobody else's matter. That's actually a possibility. So it's based on a fallacy. But you saw this in particular last summer when all of the riots and so on broke out. You see it right now. When what happened was people started talking not just about white fragility and white complicity and white supremacy, they started talking about brown fragility and brown complicity in white supremacy and brown anti-blackness. And you see it right now with the issues around the Asian American community that have come up. And I hate to say Asian American community because, first of all, there's no community. Second of all, Asian American is insufficiently granular. Chinese Americans, Korean Americans, Japanese Americans, Vietnamese Americans, Indonesian American. I mean, these people do not have the same cultural background anyway. So Asian American is already this kind of odd conglomerate that doesn't really recognize itself. And then there's no singular or unitary community among any of those groups, much less the whole thing. And then, of course, that's not even good enough. They've replaced Asian American now with AAPI to make an even, you know, an acronym-based even bigger one. But what do they say? Is, well, oh, they're intrinsically anti-Black. So even though right now in our cities they're getting beat up and they're getting robbed and they're getting assaulted and they're getting raped and all these horrific things are happening and they're being discriminated against in our schools, et cetera, under the rubric of critical race theory and race analysis, even though all this stuff is happening, it would be, especially with the beating up and the crime, it would be anti-Black to call for more police. And this taps into a long history of anti-Blackness among Asians who are a model minority, blah, 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 blah. And so what you can see is what they've done with intersectionality is said, oh, AAPI people, Asian American people, you guys are all an oppressed minority. And we have this solidarity network called intersectionality where you can understand your oppression, blah, 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 carry water for this movement. And then the second something, either, you know, the second the grift is available, whether it's power or money, the extortion racket is available, it's like, whoops, you're anti-Black too. The whole anti kicks up in one direction. And that direction is, we even saw that last summer too, by the way, with Black Lives Matter wasn't enough. You had trans Black Lives Matter came out, you know, and it's like, you can see the direction that everything points in a particular direction. And it is intersectionality, so totalizing theory of identity, even though Kimberly Crenshaw said in 1991 that she didn't intend it to be, and I don't believe her. It is a totalizing theory of identity that causes people to focus on their factors of identity and divide themselves and sort themselves by factors of identity and other factors. I heard today, in fact, that children in schools are sorting themselves by how tall they are and all kinds of other things. You know, where this, you know, you can't be in our group because you're too short or you're too tall or whatever. They're just sorting themselves and sorting themselves into more and more, you know, into little collectives, not into each person's individual unless learned across are different. No, little collectives. But it, at the same time as it being a totalizing theory of identity, it was constructed as a solidarity-based racketeering effort to kick advantage and money and power and grift toward queer, Black, feminist socialists, which is way more accuracy than they like having told about them.
I want to get into the mindset of one of the postmodern thinkers, Michel Foucault. In What is Enlightenment, he says, what must be grasped is the extent to which what we know of it, in reference to historical generalities, the forms of power that are exercised in it, and the experience that we have in it ourselves, constitute nothing but determined historical figures through a certain form of problematization that defines objects, rules of actions, modes of relations to oneself. What does that mean?
I almost have to ask you to read it again. So this is, first of all, let me just say that this is typical of how the French postmodernists wrote. There was, a lot of people don't understand this, there was actually a kind of academic social norm within the French milieu in the mid-20th century that maybe still persists, but less, that the belief was basically, genuinely, that if people could understand more than about 70% of what you had to say, you were probably not that smart. And so there was this kind of showing off with these complicated statements and complicated sentences and complicated words and very complicated ideas. And it's not entirely clear all the time that they even knew what they meant themselves, but it probably is the case. So Foucault is actually talking there primarily, and again, to get all of it, I probably have to hear it again because it was a lot, but he's talking primarily about the idea that we are in fact caught up in historically contingent, thus culturally contingent processes. There's no external perspective from which somebody like yourself or I could step aside and say, we're looking at the world objectively, this is what's true. In fact, we have to say, no, we're actually denizens of the 21st century who live in the United States. And that cultural milieu shades how we think, shades how we know. We are not separate from the processes of history. We are not separate from the contingencies of history. We're not separate from the culture in which we find ourselves embedded. And therefore, that colors the way that we think, even though we tend to think that that's not what's going on. We tend to think of ourselves as independent of that, whereas in fact, we are not independent of that. And the most generous thing to do would say, oh, well, we need a proper recognition, acknowledgement, and accounting for that when we try to figure things out. Am I just leaning into a particular bias? But Foucault was more hopeless than that and kind of believed that there was no avenue by which such a thing could be resolved. Everything comes back to that same problem. So it's sort of indicative, you know, of the postmodern thought about knowledge and about the contingency of history to the way contingencies of history would mean that whatever cultural context you find yourself in ultimately frames out everything that you say, everything that you think, every way that you're able to live your life or be, even what, if you were to talk about liberty, what liberty means is all conditioned by the society. You know, what an American in the 21st century thinks of as liberty might not match what Thomas Jefferson thought of as liberty, or might not match what somebody who lives in China in the 21st century thinks of as liberty. And, you know, I've honestly had conversations with people in China who explain that liberty is not having to think for yourself, being told what to do, which is inimical to the idea of liberty here, you know. But they think, no, you're free to live your life the way that you want to if you're just told what to do all the time, because you don't have to think about all of that. You know, you don't have to figure out for yourself how you're going to order your affairs. You don't have to figure out for yourself what you're going to do with your life. You're just told, you know, go be a doctor, go be a janitor, go be the guy who has a, this is real in China, a broom tied to the back of his bike that rides up and down the highway for pennies a day to street sweep so that they have zero unemployment. You're just told what to do and you don't have to think about it. And that's free. It's freeing in this line of thinking. And so Foucault would say, there's no way for us to evaluate, because we're trapped in our own cultural context here in America, and say, that's actually totalitarianism. That's not freedom. And there would be no way for the Chinese in their context to look at what we're doing and say, well, Americans think they're free, but they're chained to all of the things they have to do to manage their own lives. There's no way for either of those two cultures to communicate and to resolve that difference or to resolve that distinction. That's kind of what he's talking about, being trapped within those particular contingencies of history and thus culture.
There was a research book on the Frankfurt School where it summarizes Horkheimer, the Frankfurt School's accredited founder, saying the dichotomy of absolutism and relativism was in fact a false one. Each period of time has its own truth, Horkheimer argued. Although there is none above time, what is true is whatever fosters social change in the direction of a rational society. Why is there such an attack on objective truth and morality?
Because that's where objective things remove power from people who want to have power. Objective, that which is objective is something to which every person has to defer. It's external to every individual. And so nobody has any authority to proclaim over the objective. If we were Christian, you would say nobody has the authority to proclaim over God. If we're strictly scientists, we'd say nobody has the authority to say that the world is other than it is. But if we get rid of this idea that there's objective truth, then all of a sudden there have to be people who are considered the authenticators of truth. And those people become empowered. Those people become the experts. Those people become the technocrats who can order and run society through their dicta. And so that's why there's an assault on objective truth. That's why there's the attempt to tear this down, is because it empowers the people. So when you have Horkheimer there remarking that, you know, we have to be heading toward a rational society, it should also be remarked that Horkheimer was a neo-Marxist. Thus, Horkheimer imbibed and believed a lot of Marxian thought. And so for Marx, remember that Marx said that the dialectical materialism is the true science of society, the true science of history, and that it is the socialism is the rational, and then communism is the truly rational way to live and to order a society. Therefore, when he says that we anything that doesn't point toward a more rational society, what he actually means is anything that doesn't point toward communism, because the communists believe And they still believe that true rationality, true science, and true democracy all exist only under a communist system. So when you put those two things together, that statement then becomes very indicative of what's going on. You have these philosopher types, these Marxian philosopher types or neo-Marxist philosophers who want to be able to order society in the direction of a communist utopia that they believe is possible. And what they want to do is undermine the idea of objective truth, because that's what would reveal them to be charlatans. That's what would reveal them to be utopians. That would reveal them to be, in fact, totalitarians who want to control the way everybody thinks. If you don't understand this about communism, it's a very important point. The fundamental belief of communism and the reason it ends up murdering so many people, not starving them necessarily, that's just its failure, but the reason it ends up murdering so many people, so many dissidents, so many people get carted off to gulags, is specifically because the communist belief in re-education camps is that communism will work when everybody has the proper communist consciousness. When everybody's awakened to the truth of communism, that's when it will work. That's when it will spontaneously begin to take shape and to function, which is, of course, incorrect. But what does that mean? It means that you have to eliminate people who are irrational. You have to eliminate people who are not fitting in with that program, people who are not re-educatable, people who are not able to be awakened out of reality into the false power struggle that they're actually trying to thrust people into. And so the assault on objective truth is an assault on the ability to put brakes on that train. In some sense, I said this recently, it's as though critical theories and communism before that have unleashed a train rolling down a hill. And assaults on things like objective truth, for example, remove the brakes on that train. And at the bottom of the hill, there's a cliff, and it's going to fly off. But what they've done is tried to, like, it's already rolling. The question is what's going to happen. And what they are doing with the assault on objective truth is trying to remove the brakes so that there's no way to stop that train, because they think once the train comes off the tracks and falls into the cliff, everything's going to be perfect. That's where it is. So.
In 1943, James Burnham wrote The Machiavellian's Defenders of Freedom. He wrote about the iron law of oligarchy and says, whatever social changes occur, whatever happens to economic relations, whether property is in private hands or socialized, organization will remain, and through organization, an oligarchical rule will be perpetuated. In other words, even if you're in a union of people trying to seek equality, only some people show up to the meetings, and only some people speak, and one or two people, or 1% of people, are going to decide what the rules are and use their linguistic or rhetorical tactics to convince the large people of how to vote. So oligarchy is almost an iron rule in nature. Do you think critical race theory and postmodernism is therefore a fool's errand because it doesn't accept the Pareto principle or the iron law of oligarchy?
Postmodernism, yes. Postmodernism misunderstands those rules of hierarchy in society. Critical race theory, no, because critical race theory actually wants to become the oligarchs. The goal of critical race theory is to enforce critical race theory as the iron rule. It is to become that 1% who shows up to all the meetings, who talks at every school board meeting, who takes all of the positions of bureaucratic power in particular. They very rarely want to be like the president of a thing or the head of a thing. They usually want to be in administrative and bureaucratic roles. This was the danger with Joe Biden. People say, oh, is Joe Biden critical race theorist? Is he woke? Blah, blah, blah. And it's like, it doesn't matter. His administrative state with 5,000 or whatever unaccountable appointees will be largely influenced by the ideology. And that's what it wants to do, is it wants to occupy those bureaucratic positions. And it wants to show up to the meeting so that it does, in fact, create the de facto oligarchy. But when you have it in service to an ideology like that, we no longer call it an oligarchy. We call it a party with a capital P. And that is the objective of critical race theory. So critical race theory is not purely postmodern. It is, in fact, it uses postmodernism, but is largely based also in critical theory and neo-Marxism, which sought to create that, you know, so-called rational liberated society. In other words, a kind of Marxist style, but not exactly Marxist utopia, where with themselves in charge, they would be the Leninist what do they call it, the vanguard or whatever, that's going to shepherd society through the process of racial liberation by empowering themselves. So critical race theory does not fail to understand this. It may talk about it as being a problem, and it says that there's all these hierarchies, but it's very blatantly, like we talked about with intersectionality, creating an alternative hierarchy that puts itself strongly into power. And as far as that iron law goes, it's probably correct. And what this means is that we constantly have in societies that we want to have be free by one means or another, whether that's minimizing the size of government or institutional apparatuses, whether it's, you know, other means, whether it's separation of powers, whatever it happens to be, some set of means have to be devised that minimize the ability for the oligarchs to have absolute or tyrannical influence over the populations or systems that they control. That is the underlying goal of successful political systems that avoid tyranny. And critical race theory is trying to do exactly the opposite of that. They are trying to make themselves that 1% who control everything. People, I think, have realized this in the past 3 to 6 months rather rapidly, which is a little bit encouraging.
Professor Stephen Hicks says, the failure of epistemology made postmodernism possible, and the failure of socialism made postmodernism necessary. Do you agree with that?
Yes, largely. Hicks and I have some very slight disagreements around the idea of ideas of how counter-enlightenment Kant was, but otherwise, I agree with the majority of his analysis. I think he's a little bit, I used to think anyway, I'm not sure now, a little bit bent on the idea that it was all, you know, an attempt to keep bringing communism into the picture, but now I'm kind of more convinced that that is the case. Postmodernism, though, itself, I don't think postmodernism developed intentionally as a set of tools to undermine Western civilization so that communism could come into play. I think it just developed itself as a set of tools to undermine civilizations, period, all of them. And then people who had communist agendas were able to pick it up and then use it in that regard. So, you know, I think Hicks is broadly correct there. Yeah, just with a little bit of nuance there. The postmodernists themselves, I don't think were nearly as purposed in what they were doing as people think they were. But the people who picked up postmodern tools in the next generation of thought certainly are, which then links, you know, to what Hicks is writing there. I think that postmodernism, by the way, is a failure of authenticity, primarily. It is also critical theory is in another way, but there's this disconnection from the real. They feel like society has progressed to a point where nothing can be real. There is no connection to the real. Nobody can understand who they really are. Everybody's caught up in, whether you hear it from, like, you know, Foucault, who's talking about the idea that we're culturally conditioned and just contingent, you know, avatars of the cultures we find ourselves in, whether you hear it from Herbert Marcuse, the neo-Marxist, who's talking about the idea that we're subject to all of the heteronomous interests of consumer capitalism. There's this idea that there's this gigantic disconnection from authenticity, that it's impossible to be yourself and to be real. And I think that that's ultimately what this is all kind of speaking into, especially in the, you know, modern, and then going into what we would now be in the postmodern. I hold up my cell phone as an example of the very digital, you know, almost hyper real world that we live in now. There's this crisis of authenticity, and I think that the root of a lot of that is a crisis of authenticity. But certainly the neo-Marxists were angry, vengeful people who wanted to install a communist-type utopia. I don't think the postmodernists were. I think they had given up on everything. I think they were just pessimists and wanted to just question everything at its very foundations.
What is falsification, and why is it important to be able to falsify a theory?
Yeah, so Karl Popper laid out the idea of falsification, which has become one of the cornerstone objects of scientific thought. So what Popper argued was that it's not that you can show that something is true in the scientific process, but it is possible to show something is wrong. So, you know, somebody can forward an idea, you can show disconfirming evidence that knocks it down off of its pedestal, and now that's not correct anymore. And so you can disconfirm these things. And so what Popper said is that for a theory to be scientific, didn't say that this is the only way to think about things or the only kind of knowledge, he said, but for a theory to be considered scientific, the hypotheses it forwards must be falsifiable. You can't have something that's so vague that, you know, you can then argue, even if you were presented with contradictory evidence, oh, well, it's still right because some other complicated thing. You could use the example of astrology and say, well, you know, you don't really act like a Taurus or whatever. And you say, oh, well, that's because my moon is in Scorpio, you know, or my ascendant is in, I don't know, another one, Capricorn or something. And so, you know, there's these abilities to dodge the, or, you know, well, I would, but Mercury's in retrograde. There's no like tight, clear way by which the statements put forth by a model like astrology can properly be shown to be false. And so what Popper said is, if we're going to consider something scientific, which isn't the only way to get to knowledge, but if we're going to consider something scientific, it has to be able to be falsified. It has to be able to be shown to be incorrect. And that which does not fall to falsification, those hypotheses which cannot be falsified, are ones that we will take provisionally to be true or regard as true, with the idea that it's still possible that maybe we will uncover the necessary evidence at some point later. So why falsification is so important is because we're human beings are engines of the opposite. We are engines of confirmation bias. We're engines of desirability bias. We desperately, so if you have an idea, whatever it is, you know, that, you know, electrolytes are what plants crave, for example. That's your idea. And you decide you're going to start, what are you going to do? Most people are going to try to find ways to confirm that. So they're going to add electrolytes to water and water the plants, or add electrolytes to the soil and water, you know, and fertilize the soil with electrolytes. They're going to try to find ways to confirm it. That's what we generally tend to do. We get an idea and we try to find out reasons why we're correct. That's called confirmation bias. And sometimes it's that we don't want to face the alternatives or whatever, or we really want something to be true. We really want the person to like us. And so we have a bias of desirability. The thing we want to be true, we look for reasons why that would be the case. Falsification says, look, if we're going to get properly scientific knowledge, we can't have vague theories that could be anything, like astrology or bibliomancy or reading of tea leaves and entrails. We can't do that. Vague social theories. We need to have falsifiable hypotheses. And then secondly, what we have to be able to do is step into that realm where, you know, ideas can be cut down and we retain what is right, so that we avoid the confirmation bias that we're looking for. So rather than becoming engine, if we want to get the right answers, rather than being engines of confirmation bias, we want to become rational users of disconfirmation technology, if you will, or even to adopt a consummate scientist would have a so-called skeptical orientation, which would actually be a bias toward disconfirming things. When I'm trained as a mathematician, and so one of the first mistakes all would-be mathematicians make is, you know, you're given a proposition, a conjecture, or whatever, and you dive in to try to prove it. But after you get a little seasoning, what you actually learn to start doing is to look for, rather than looking for a way to confirm the thing that's in front of you, start looking for contradictions, start looking for counterexamples specifically. And we're all trained, when you take, you know, under elementary number theory, we're all trained about this famous example. I forget if it's the Mersenne primes or one of these famous sequences or one of these famous types of prime numbers. They're not sequences. And, you know, what happened was, back in the day, they're very large numbers. They're very difficult to calculate and check. But back in the day, they checked the first one and it's a prime. They checked the second one and it's a prime. And they did that all the way up to the sixth one and it's a prime. And they said, aha, these are always prime. It turns out the seventh one's not prime. And so, but it's really, so what you start to do is you train yourself to look for those disconfirming counterexamples, those places where the thing you think might be true is probably wrong. And this is a very difficult discipline for thought. It's a very difficult habit of mind to adopt, to seek disconfirmation rather than confirmation. And that's really what Popper's leaning into. So no ideas that are so vague that we that they could be, that you can't possibly have them, they can't possibly be wrong. They're so interpretive, their interpretive range is too wide to tell you anything or to ever be showed to be incorrect on the one hand. And then on the other hand is to avoid the problems of confirmation bias and desirability bias, also something like the availability heuristic. A lot of these very simple biases and logical errors that can lead people down rabbit holes that go the wrong way away from truth.
That's really important, because when I had once said, I'm having person X on my show, and they go, oh God, you hang out with that racist? And I said, first of all, define racism. And I got almost all of his books in front of me. Where did he embrace racism or promote this racist ideology? I got to get that definition first, though. And of course, the definition is something like the institutionalized foundational ideologies that stem, that are embedded within the majority group in a certain demographic within a certain time based on prejudice. It's like, well, from that, you can't get anything. How about this one? I constantly hear about, Robin DiAngelo, very popular, Jimmy Kimmel's show, always talking about privilege. Now, I cannot imagine why I would ever, say, walk up to a Jewish person and say, you have privilege, your people have higher incomes than whites. Asians, you people are privileged, you have higher incomes than whites. Black Americans are privileged because they are better off than Black Liberians, so they need to embrace their privilege and read this book called Black Fragility. And women have privilege because they're less likely to be homeless and they have longer life expectancies. The only reason I would ever do that is if I were Iago, the Shakespearean character, trying to divide people based on lies and technicalities. Why on earth is this privilege something they put so much focus on?
Because it works. Because it works, that's why. So the concept, I'm just going to cut straight to bare bones. I've not really talked about this publicly much yet. I put it on Twitter, but I haven't really dialogued about it. But the concept of privilege is a Maoist concept. It is a concept to divide society into groups, to stratify, in fact, or to identify stratification or claim stratification society, to divide people into the haves and the have-nots, and to put stink on the have. There is no, like, privilege is not a positive word. You know, I might say it's a privilege to be able to speak with you, or a privilege to appear on your show. And that's one thing. Of course, all these words have multiple meanings, but that's a different thing entirely to say you are privileged, which means, what does privilege mean? It means, oh, well, you have unearned advantages and you probably think you deserve them. That is just something that is meant to knock people down. This is legitimately the same concept that was used with the people who had, you know, standing in society in the Mao's Cultural Revolution. It is a Maoist idea. They use it because it works. Because exactly what you said about Iago, because it does divide people, and that is the goal. It is the goal to get people to divide themselves across these lines of stratification, to make it so that, say, poor whites and poor blacks now can't unify and realize that maybe elites of society are screwing them both at the same way, because now the white people are privileged over the black people and they have their own class conflict that they now have to have in terms of privilege, and they have to fight with each other rather than realizing that they're in the same circumstance. So it's a very divisive kind of thing. It's meant to knock down the people who are being labeled privileged. It's meant to create a scapegoating situation of those groups. And it's also meant to induce shame. If you look at the Maoist Cultural Revolution, that was the entire purpose, was to shame people, publicly shame people, humiliate people into doing the bidding of the Red Guard, into doing the bidding of the Maoists. And that's exactly what the purpose of the concept of privilege is. This is to shame the people who are labeled as privileged, as needing to reflect until they understand why they should be ashamed, and then to use that shame as a motivator to work in so-called solidarity on behalf of the people who have less privilege or who are oppressed. It is a pretty vile manipulation tactic. There's pretty much nothing nice about it. But it's also a means, you know, when you attach it to something like race, of doing racial scapegoating, which is extremely poisonous and extremely divisive, extremely dangerous.
I spoke with an intelligence officer, Chase Hughes, of the behavioral panel, and he said that if I could describe mind control in one word, it would be repetition. How is repetition used by social justice activists?
I mean, they have a variety. I don't know if you've read Robert J. Lifton. Robert J. Lifton studied, in fact, Mao, the circumstances around Chinese Cultural Revolution, and was particularly interested in understanding the patterns of thought control. And so repetition is certainly a way that you can condition somebody. But simultaneously, what they do within this kind of woke approach is they have this variety of things that Lifton called thought-stopping techniques, or thought-stopping ideas. And so, you know, do the work, you know, silence is violence. And then they sloganize these things. They're all very Black Lives Matter. These are all very sloganized things. There's not a lot of thought involved. But then they say them and stick them and write them everywhere. They chant them. Silence is violence, you know, in particular. Silence is complicity. These very simple slogans that then get repeated again and again and again and again and again. You see it in particular also with the attempt to name everything that goes wrong in society as a manifestation of whiteness or white supremacy. You know, something's gone wrong, white. Something's gone wrong, white. Something's gone wrong, white. Over and over and over and over and over and over again. And these are, in fact, kind of cult conditioning techniques. And then when you add in these thought-stopping techniques and the idea that somebody who deviates is somehow, you know, going to be punished, you end up having quite the effect of kind of cult indoctrination going on. And the ideology is extremely effective at this.
Well, look at how the corporate press will so selectively choose to report on some stories and not others. The white officer shot the black victim. When there are more whites killed by officers, now, of course, we're getting into they're disproportionately targeted, whatever. Well, so are men, but they commit more crime. The point is that if you hear about the story, it's not because it's just out there and they're just unbiasedly reporting the news. They are choosing to report on some things and not others. Dave Rubin makes the great point in his book, Don't Burn This Book, that yes, climate change and the environment is something vitally important we should focus on. But please realize you're always hearing about these environmental disasters. If you are afraid of environmental disasters, there's never been a better time than today to be alive because of technology and better infrastructure and better communication methods to get people safe and to warn them ahead of time. So you never hear about that. I mean, how often will the corporate press say, in the year 1700, 95% of humanity lived in poverty. Today, it's closer to 15%. Let's you know, hooray for that. You know, there isn't a world war or something. They're constantly using this fear and repetition in order to get us into this terrified state to look to the critical race theorists for the solution for everything. I want to thank you so much.
You can look at that with the cases of, like, the so-called insurrection on January 6th at the Capitol, right? So all of this happens, and when you hear white supremacists, this is a saturation news cycle. You have the Congress going through, like, its own struggle sessions and crying. The Congress is crying in front of the nation. Like, what the hell? And so this is going on. And then literally this week, like 4 days ago or something like this, there was a black man and a member of the Nation of Islam who drove his car into police officers at the Capitol, crashed into a barricade, got out with a long knife, you know, this whole thing. This got reported on and vanished almost immediately. So there is a selective repetition of stories that serve a particular narrative that push in a particular direction. And this is absolutely a part. We see this also with the coronavirus, right? So it's like new strain, new variant, new strain, double mutation, new strain, new variant, vaccine, 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 new
cases
strain.
Cases are up. Cases are up.
Yeah, of course. And again and again and again and again, the same repetition, the same repetition. And then you have states like Florida and Texas humiliating that narrative. And rather than cases are up, which they can no longer say, they have to lean into new strain, new variant, you know, the whole thing. And so there is this, I mean, I think it's legitimately, I don't know whether it's happening fully organically or quasi-organically or somewhat organically, or not at all organically. I'm not going to make any claims about, like, conspiracy or whatever, but it's virtually taken on the effective, it is effectively a psyops at this point. The media, I don't know if they've, my running hypothesis is that they psyops themselves They like got such a bad case of Trump derangement syndrome that they drove themselves literally nuts, and they just keep repeating this stuff. You can hear, like, with Jordan Peterson, he has this really great talk about how did Hitler become Hitler with the Nazis. And he says, you know, Hitler didn't make Hitler Hitler. You have to put responsibility, but Hitler was interacting with his crowd. So Hitler would get on stage and he would say some crazy stuff, and he would hear, you know, when did the crowd roar? When did the crowd cheer? And then what Peterson says is that anybody with just 5 or 6 people would be so swayed by this that they could be led way off the track, right? And then imagine 100 people or millions of people cheering. And so what you had with the news media with Trump derangement, for example, was look at the ratings. CNN, MSNBC are complaining that their ratings are on the toilet. We just saw what Jim Acosta and Brian Stelter and somebody else go up on TV. And they're like, we kind of have Trump withdrawals. We don't know what to do without Trump. They drove themselves so nuts that they led themselves literally into crazy land, into Blue Anon, as some people are jokingly calling it, like these left-wing conspiracy theories. And at some point, functionally speaking, this becomes a psyops. Their craziness is being projected onto everybody else in this rampant attempt to keep pushing the narrative that only they believe. And it's driving people nuts. It's like the repetition is part of that, but they've also repeated it to themselves so many times and then had it reflected back to them by a panicked audience that was just gobbling it up. If you look at the ratings, just gobbling it up, that I think they psyopsed themselves and then use that to psyops us. And repetition is a huge, huge piece of that political warfare.
Well, any day now, Mueller is going to come out with part 2 of the report and prove collusion. So then you'll be really sorry. Final question, sir. Thank you so much for your time. Why is social justice theory false?
Well, this is a complicated thing. So if we're going to talk about social justice theory, I assume you mean the way that we've described it in cynical theories. And
yes.
So social justice are both capitalized letters, and theory is capitalized as well. Okay, so what that actually refers to, that's a kind of a shorthand so that it's accessible. The formal name for this is called critical social justice by authors like Robin DiAngelo, or another much more academically formal name for this is called critical constructivism. And the reason that it's false is because it doesn't reflect reality. It assumes a particular theoretical lens, which is critique, and that's in the form of critical theory, which is, I could describe for you at some length why critical theory is a very biased way. We already talked about Horkheimer and his whole thing, but what Horkheimer laid out when he defined critical theory in 1937 for the first time was that for a theory to be considered a critical theory, it has to satisfy 3 criteria at a minimum. It has to have a normative vision of a perfected society, a utopia, and it has to be able to critique how the society that we currently inhabit doesn't live up to that or isn't heading in that rational direction, as he would put it. And then 3, it has to inspire social activism. So this is what critical means. So this is already a problem because it has its conclusion in mind. It has its direction in mind. And what it's designed to do is not necessarily understand something. Horkheimer separated traditional theory out for understanding the world, but rather to understand how the world is not headed in that so-called rational communist direction. And so it already has its goal in mind. So critical is already a problem. And it uses the method of complaining, raising contradictions, bringing up division, agitating, creating alienation. It's a very poisonous, negative, cynical, pessimistic approach. That's already damaging. Okay, so then that's the critical aspect. Achieving social justice through critical social justice, which is social justice theory, that's probably not going to work real well. But then what I said is that formally it is constructivist. It's critical constructivist, which means it relies upon the social constructivism thesis of postmodernism. That's wrong too. It's not to say that nothing in our society is socially constructed. Certainly there are norms that are socially constructed. If you go to the ball game, which would not be baseball because we don't go to baseball games anymore, apparently. But that's a joke. But, you know, if you go to say you got your team and everybody goes, I saw this, baseball came to mind because I remember watching the World Series with the Astros, and they for some reason in their ballpark, they have a train or something like this as like a gimmick or something. What that has to do with rockets and stars, I don't know, but they have a train. And so there's these weird, like, you know, little dances that people do at certain times, like the train dance or, you know, or the wave or whatever it is. And that there will be patterns, you know, and people will say certain chants. So social constructions do come up, right? Social conventions do come up, and they do dictate aspects of our lives. We have our inside jokes in all of our social groups. These are social constructions as well. We also have socially constructed beliefs. I would say that they're not totally wrong, for example, to say that gender is largely socially constructed. Where they are wrong is to believe that it's divorced from sex. The social constructions that define what gender is are overwhelmingly dependent upon the underlying biology in a very complicated way. They're not arbitrary. They're not just social constructions. They're social constructions rooted in the fact that there's biology and that these things within certain contexts have led to more successful reproduction or mating or dating or whatever it happens to be. And so these things are, or, you know, functioning societies, maybe with masculine and feminine norms, these things are not arbitrary. So the social constructivist thesis that everything is just socially constructed and therefore can be questioned in a very foundational way and replaced by other social constructions if we just get great enough consensus around it is a false theory. So if you have this idea, also the social construction of knowledge is more false than true. It's got like this tiny kernel of truth to it that our scientific theories are ultimately expressed in language. They're ultimately, you know, they are models. They are not actually reality. They're descriptions of reality. But philosophers of science who are more careful have actually dealt with this. We could talk about John Searle. We could talk about Hawking, Stephen Hawking, Leonard Mlodinow. They've all dealt with this kind of thing. This isn't confusing to anybody but social theorists. So when you talk about the social constructivist theory of knowledge, this is just preposterous. There are true things about the world. The objective world does exist. We can actually very approximately know things about it. And in a functional sense, we can just say we know them. We don't have to have some weird absolute perfection of knowledge for it to count. And since you take both of those aspects of constructivism, it's just wrong. There are social constructions, and social constructions should be investigated and looked at and studied, et cetera. And we should understand them. And where they are stupid, you know, like racism was a socially constructed phenomenon, and it was bad, and we questioned it and we tore it down. That was good. But everything's not socially constructed. And so the social constructivist thesis is incorrect. The critical method is incorrect and poisonous. And when you put those two things together, you don't get something better, you get something worse. And so the social justice theory, the capital T theory of the social justice movement, is absolutely an impoverished way to think. Most importantly, though, just to kind of wrap back to critical race theory where we kind of began, it assumes, like I said, critical race theory assumes that racism is the ordinary state of affairs, then uses critical methods to find it. It assumes its conclusion and then works its way to that. That's automatically a terrible way to go. Anything that does that is sophistry. It's not a theory. It's not even remotely close to it. It's not even a hypothesis. Saying that racism is the ordinary state of affairs of society and embedded in all of the fabric of society is a metaphor. It's not even falsifiable. It's not even a hypothesis. It's mythology, literally mythology. And so it's wrong because its premises are all wrong, and it misunderstands humanity, which it doesn't seek to understand. It misunderstands society. It has an agendist goal operating underneath it. It's literally difficult to think of a worse way to go about achieving the... Occasionally, there are some very noble ends that this movement seems to be, you know, after. It's about treating people more fairly. It's about being, you know, it's about getting over racism. These are all great things. But this is, you could hardly devise a worse way to go about it. And the reason this is such a bad way isn't necessarily because the people are bad people, although that's probably true of some of them. The reason is probably mostly that it's just a backwards theory. It gets everything wrong in kind of its desperation to make change without, you know, making change. Their method matters. If you want to change something, you have to do it right, right? If you want to change your tire on your car, you have to do it right. You can't just, you know, stick a different wheel on there. You can't just like hack at it with an axe or whatever. you actually have to do it correctly. The method matters. And they've got like the worst, their method is like, we need to change the tire, blow up the car.
Unbelievable. Cynical theories, how universities made everything about race, gender, and identity, and why it harms everyone. Dr. Lindsay, thank you so much for your time. A link to the book as well as new discourses will be in the description below. Dr. Lindsay, thank you so much for being so generous with your time.
Thanks, Keith. I appreciate it.